This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Richard Louv. He's the author of many books, including Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. He will be speaking at 7 in the evening this Sunday, the 21st of February, at the Lenzig Performing Arts Center. It's part of a program, The New Nature Movement, hosted by the Santa Fe Waldorf School, with presenting sponsor, the Journey Montessori School. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
So, nature deficit disorder, it's not a real, like, psychiatric term from the diagnostic manual, but it's a term that people understand immediately when they hear it. How did you come across this whole idea?
Well, in the late 1980s, I was doing interviews for a different book, an earlier book called Childhood's Future, and I interviewed about 3,000 parents and children and teachers, usually in groups, in classrooms and living rooms all over the country. And I was looking for the repeating themes of what was changing in the realities of family life. And this is one that kept coming up, that parents themselves talked about, even kids would talk about. They didn't really have a language to describe it, though. And so in the chapter in that book, I called it that chapter, The Nature of Childhood. It was picked up by several magazines, including Sierra Magazine and Utney Reader. But at that point, it was just anecdotal evidence that something profound was happening in the relationship between children and nature. But over the next decade, a new body of research began to emerge, two bodies of research. One was about the disconnect itself, which, unlike any time in history, people were, children in particular, were disconnecting from experiences in the natural world. But at the same time, a body of evidence was beginning to show just how great nature was for healthy child development, and in fact for human development throughout our lives. So those two bodies of research then gave me a book to write. So that's where that came. The idea of nature deficit disorder, by the way, you're correct that that's not a known medical diagnosis, and I never presented it as that. It is, though, the shorthand way of describing what many of us have felt was happening along the way, and gives us a way to have a conversation about it.
There's several reasons why kids aren't playing outdoors as much, and you have one chapter on the criminalization of playing outdoors. You, throughout the book, talk about I think you must have a particular love of tree houses, because they do come up quite a lot. And even tree houses are no longer considered a regular part of childhood.
Yeah, I had to edit out quite a few tree houses out of the book. there were too many of them. Yeah, believe me, there were many more than you read. Yeah, the tree houses are a thing you don't see done very much anymore. Part of the reason for this is because cities have outlawed the building of tree houses in public space. Even if you live in a newer neighborhood, often those newer neighborhoods are controlled by CC&Rs, covenants and restrictions, controlled by community associations, which, you know, say what color your house is now in Santa Fe. You know, that turns out looking pretty good in Santa Fe for, restrictions on what color your house can be and all of that. But in many communities around the country, planned communities, just try to put up a basketball hoop, let alone let the kids build a fort or a treehouse. It's not going to happen. One woman in La Jolla in a planned community told me her community association had outlawed chalk drawing on the sidewalks, which apparently leads to cocaine addiction. In our communities, in our schools, in our cities, increasingly the litigious atmosphere of our country, many factors are making it seem as if playing outdoors is almost illegal. There are some condo associations, by the way, that have actually tried to outlaw outdoor play by children who live in that condo complex. So we're sending a message to kids in many ways that there's something somewhat illegitimate about playing outdoors, particularly if you're playing outdoors in nature.
There's a lot of pieces to that, and one of them is fear. One of them is a kind of exaggerated need for order and almost a kind of sterile outdoors. Where do these fears come from? I mean, I remember those fears weren't there when I was a kid. We took, I mean, my friends and I, especially in the summer, we would make sandwiches in the morning. We would go out on our bikes. We would come home at sunset. And our parents never even asked where we were. They weren't afraid. What's going on now?
Well, part of the reason for the fear is, in fact, fear of strangers, even though the statistics are the opposite. Actual crime against children outside the home has been going down for at least 30 years. What's been going up is a 24-hour news cycle, the number of times that a handful, and one is too many, but a handful of violent crimes against children outside the home are repeated over and over and over again. All you have to do is watch CNN or Fox or headline news, and you'll see this phenomenon. And it's the very definition of conditioning. There are actually around 120 or less or fewer child abductions in America every year. And now that's too many. But most people think it's thousands, and that's because of this conditioning impact that particularly electronic media, but also print media have.
And also this kind of sterility, like these planned communities where grass is supposed to be perfectly manicured and untouched, is to be looked at rather than played on.
Right. In some of the planned communities, you'll see a lot of open space, but it doesn't mean anybody can step on it. And increasingly, we've seen the outdoors as a soccer field, you know, as something that needs to be tidy and neat, and only organized sports for children are, you know, that's the way that kids are supposed to get out now. The irony is that the greatest increase in child obesity in our history occurred during the same two decades as the greatest increase in organized sports for children in our history. That doesn't mean organized sports is causing child obesity, but it does suggest that it's not doing the trick. It's not enough. And the kind of play that many of us in earlier generations did that was kind of nonstop, you got home, you threw your books on the couch, and you ran outside. Maybe you played touch football. Maybe you went into the fields or the woods like I did and built a fort. Whatever it was, you were doing it almost all the time when you weren't sleeping or studying. You didn't have that much homework when you got home from school in earlier decades. So we've also, in our school districts, school district after school district has either canceled or cut back on play, on recess. Field trips are a thing of the past. Now, there is a counter trend to that. There's a school in Texas, for instance, that has recently said, we're going to do it like Finland does, and we're going to have four recesses in grade school, four recesses a day of 15 minutes each. And that's the way it's done in Finland, only more so. Oftentimes, those recesses are in natural play spaces. And in Finland, grades are much higher than ours on standardized testing. They do much better on science and math than our students do. But we've been going in the opposite direction of continually banning outdoor play, not having the outdoor field trips, cutting back on recess. So, you know, much of what I try to encourage, and many of us try to encourage, is a counter movement, which more schools are having outdoor play spaces, gardens on the school grounds. So this is very much a counter trend. Waldorf schools, by the way, were early on this and have been doing this for decades. So, I'm hoping we take that as a model more than where we've been in the No Child Left Behind era.
I think one of the points that's really important about what you're talking about and writing about is it's not only being outdoors. I mean, you're outdoors when you play soccer, but that kind of unstructured, unsupervised, observant time. I think many of us can remember that you discover things about flowers or frogs or insects or grass when you're by yourself and nobody's watching over you, and there's a kind of creativity and role for imagination that happens under those circumstances.
That's very true. And it's true for adults, too. And there is a book that I wrote that came out after Last Child in the Woods called The Nature Principle. And that's about adults and nature deficit disorder and the fact that we need these things, too. It's good for our physical health, our mental health, our cognitive functioning, to spend more time outdoors. That's what this new body of evidence is showing.
When you compare the childhoods of baby boomers, and you describe your own and that of so many people who grew up in the 50s and 60s and to some extent the 70s, when you compare that to the way so many kids are raised today, there are some odd paradoxes. On the one hand, there was so much more freedom then of the kind that we've been talking about. On the other hand, that was the era that was laying the foundation for the very environmental problems and overdevelopment and species endangerment and so on that we have today that is making our kids suffer, and the media world that we have too. And kids now have, in many ways, much more awareness than we had. So it's a kind of funny irony.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, now kids know just about everything about the Amazon rainforest, but they are unlikely to know the names of the plants and animals in their own backyard or in their own neighborhood. So there is this paradox where, on one hand, kids are much more aware of the environment, much more aware of the need to recycle, much more aware of endangered mega species in Africa and South America and all of that, but they don't have the intimate contact. They don't have the experience of being in nature just for the joy of it, or at least most kids don't. Some still do. So that is absolutely a paradox.
We're talking to Richard Louv about his book Last Child in the Woods. Now, when you talk about local nature and the importance of that, first of all, I think of a wonderful movie called The Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill. I don't know if you ever saw that, but it was about a guy who was sitting around reading an essay by the philosopher Gary Snyder, who said in this essay, if you want to commune with nature, start where you are now. So he says, okay, and goes out on his balcony in the middle of San Francisco, notices that there is a bright green parrot, and things take off from there, and it turns out that there's wild parrot flocks all over San Francisco. And that kind of noticing, you start to think about, okay, what if somebody lives in the city? What if somebody lives in the suburbs where they don't have a lot of access to real wild space? How do you encourage people to start where they are?
Well, I've got a new book coming out called Vitamin N. N is in is for nature, but Vitamin N, and it's a companion handbook to both Last Child in the Woods and The Nature Principle. It's 500 things that people can do to make their help their family and their community become more healthy through more nature. While I'm all for protecting every square inch of wilderness that we have, it actually won't be enough to provide the kind of biodiversity that we need. Also, this connection to nature shouldn't be seen as something you have to drive 2 hours to get to. It's one of the reasons why in Vitamin N and my other books, I focus more on nearby nature, the need to change cities into new kinds of cities. As of 2008, more people in the world live in cities than in the countryside. That's a huge moment in human history, and it's largely unremarked. That means one of two things. Either the human species will continue to lose whatever connection it has to the natural world, or it means the beginning of a new kind of city, a biodiverse city, a city that can, cities can become engines of biodiversity if we change our yards into native species. If we have schoolyards and parks that have more natural areas, there's a lot that can be done right outside our front door, outside our schools, around our schools, even on the school roofs. We can plant plants that bring back butterfly migration routes and bird migration routes. Our cities can be much happier and healthier places if we make them happier and healthier for other species.
It's interesting because what you're talking about, I mean, a lot of people who talk about urban design talk about designing cities sort of from scratch, but most of the people who are going to live in cities three generations from now, those cities already exist. So what you're talking about is tweaking and changing little spaces within the cities that we have now.
Right, and in my books, and particularly in Vitamin M, I talk about something called a homegrown national park, and this is a suggestion by a botanist named Doug Ptolemy. And he's done the math on this and says if we really care about biodiversity, we'll probably, the biodiversity collapse, we'll probably send less money to Brazil and send more and change our yards, this Kentucky bluegrass. Of course, in Santa Fe, there's not a lot of Kentucky bluegrass.
Right.
But to change the areas around our houses into more native species. What if it wasn't just your yard or my yard that we did that to? My wife and I did that to our yard. And believe me, it's great. It uses less water. We have critters coming back we've never seen before. I had no idea that there were native California butterflies in San Diego. Now they're in our yard. We see monarchs that we've never seen before coming through. And the great thing is I'll never have to mow again. So
All right. What
if it wasn't just my yard? What if it was the next yard and the next one and the next one and throughout our region? And then you would have essentially wildlife corridors on private land going throughout our cities. And then what if it was city to city? At that point, you're talking about a homegrown national park that we don't have to wait for Congress to pass. Lately, I just got back from China. We're for a speaking tour there, and I was suggesting, why not go the next step and make it a worldwide homegrown park? Why couldn't we have China, students in China in schools connecting with us via Skype or the Internet in some way, our schools, so that kids could trade notes on what they've done to their own schoolyards and their own yards in terms of bringing back native species and the new life that they're seeing come back.
There was a really kind of poignant incident that you write about in your book, Last Child in the Woods, in which there was a kid who was kind of unhappy and his parents were unhappy and he was playing soccer and he was overscheduled. And at a certain point, they all sat down together and said, let's just make a list of the things we love and the things we hate. And it turned out the kid didn't even like soccer, and he liked playing in his yard. And they really changed their lives as a result of that. And when you talk about making our yards into a kind of wildlife connectivity, I don't know exactly what that means for fences, but a place where, at least flying native species can have a safe home, that's something that a lot of people would do and do with great love and attention if their lives weren't perhaps so overscheduled.
Well, it's a choice. It's a choice. I mean, in Vitamin N, the book that's going to be coming out, I talk about making that choice about, the irony here is that in order for our kids and ourselves to get some semblance of unorganized experience in nature, we're probably going to have to organize it, a lot of it,
yeah.
And like it or not, and just deal with that with a sense of humor. So one of the things we have to do is put nature on the calendar, actually to schedule nature time in for our kids and ourselves. So there are a lot of ways to do that, and it turns out not to be that hard, but sometimes people need pump primers. They need to have ideas to help them do that. That's why the new book, Vitamin N, is, got 500 things that people can do.
Part of this shift that you are really advocating is about a change of attitude, not only dropping our fear of going outdoors because there's psychopathic strangers around every corner, which turns out really not to be the case, but also being scared of nature itself. We have a situation in here in Santa Fe, which is full of very nature and wilderness-oriented people, where they've cleared the prairie dogs out of all the parks, to my great sorrow. I live across the street from a park that forever had prairie dogs in it, and they took them out. They weren't doing any harm. But it was this idea that what if a child falls into or puts its foot in a prairie dog hole? And this whole idea that nature, even a park, the sort of wild end of a park, is a scary place full of dangers, as opposed to a place where you can learn to observe, to pay attention, to avoid putting your feet in holes, things like that. That's a real shift, I think.
Well, it is, and I'm sure I'll find out more about the great prairie dog controversy when I visit Santa Fe next week, and I'll be curious about that. My own city of San Diego, I mean, I live in kind of suburban area of San Diego, and 5 minutes from my house, there's a canyon that has a pair of mountain lions. That it's a city park, and the ranger there told me that there's a pair of mountain lions living there. Increasingly, wild animals are actually encountering people in urban areas. That's partly because they're coming into urban areas and adapting to urban areas. There's even some evidence that raccoons are getting smarter because they've come into urban areas, and the more we try to out-trick raccoons to move them out, the smarter they get. We're essentially doing standardized testing with raccoons to make them smarter. And the other reason is because we're moving into their territory. And I actually see that as a great opportunity. I think it's a good thing. You know, we have to be careful. We should not feed wild animals in our yards. It's not a good thing. We should know about them. We should be careful, in an appropriate way about them. But the fact that there are these wild animals in our midst now, I think, is an opportunity to build awe and wonder, not only in children, but ourselves. And it has to do with how we connect to them, why we connect to them, whether we see them as something that enriches our life, and I think they do. And this is one of the ways I think we can begin with children and with ourselves to reconnect with the natural world. And again, some of the newest studies show that the parks, the urban parks with the highest degree of benefit psychologically for human beings, are the parks with the highest level of biodiversity. So there are lessons here for future urban planning, for the future of schools, the future of our residential areas. And there are actually developers who are interested in this now, who are beginning to think about how do you build a development or redevelop an existing urban neighborhood so that it has more natural, quote-unquote, natural habitat in it. We can actually have denser urban neighborhoods but have more habitat through green roofs and design. So there's a lot of exciting things happening. And I should mention that, if you want to learn about some of the things that have emerged since Last Child in the Woods came out a decade ago, the Children and Nature Network is the nonprofit that grew out of Last Child in the Woods. And it's helping lead what has really now been recognized as a big movement, not only in this country but around the world, to reconnect kids to nature and reconnect ourselves to nature. There's a great piece, by the way, that ran that I just read. It's just out in the Santa Fe New Mexican about this movement and about the role the book has played in it. It also mentions the Lansing Performing Arts Center speech I'll be giving on February 21st. But it's a great piece that kind of gives a summary of everything that's happened since the book came out, and I really appreciated it. Although they did refer to me as, somebody in the piece refers to me as Dr. Lou, which is quite a promotion. I like to say I got a BS in journalism, which is, I always think, is kind of appropriate. I never got a PhD, let alone a master's. So thank you very much for the promotion.
Why do you think it is that the parks that have the most beneficial effect on people are the ones that are most biodiverse?
some of this is still a mystery. We really don't know. One of the I think almost academic tragedies is that only in the last 15 to 20 years has the issue of how the natural world affects child development and human development throughout our lives, only now is this being studied. It was virtually ignored before. There was a few studies, a few pioneers out there, but only now is this being studied, at the very moment that we're taking nature away from so many children and from ourselves. So this new body of evidence is I cover both in Last Child in the Woods and in the Nature Principle, but you can go to the Children and Nature Network website, which is childrenandnature.org, and there are over 300 abstracts of studies on the benefits and the disconnect from nature there, and you can make up your own mind there.
There are so many problems that young people have: obesity, depression, attention deficit disorder, and a lot of those, I mean, you make a very strong argument, can really be dealt with by walking outside. And of course, one of the problems with that is that nobody's making any money. No doctors or pharmaceutical companies or anybody else is making a profit. You can't, and I don't like this word, but there it is, monetize children's play by the pond.
Well, you know, there are ways to do that that aren't talked about very much. I mean, people could one of the things that I argue for is to broaden the definition of green jobs. I don't think green jobs should just be about solar panels and energy efficiency. It should be about nature preschool teachers, you know, working as that's a kind of green job. People who redesign backyards or yards in around our houses for more native species, that's a green job. Biophilic architects, that's a new emerging kind of architecture and design. That's another green job. It turns out, the studies have been done of the use of biophilic design, which is inserting nature into the design of a building from the beginning and then keeping it there and around that building. And the workplaces that are designed through biophilic design, more nature, workers are more productive, sick time goes down, turnover gets better. This is really good news for business if they begin to redesign the buildings in which their employees work. So there's all kinds of new jobs that we haven't even thought of yet that could be classified as green jobs that have to do with connecting people to nature. No, we can't make a pill, fortunately, for nature deficit disorder, but there are lots of ways to turn this into part of a new economy that is based in nature, on nature.
Well, and also, I mean, I think part of what I think about quite a bit is the importance of thinking of ourselves as something that is not just an economic unit in society. I mean, we are first and foremost human beings, and the economic component is important, but it's not the only thing that we are.
I think that's true, and there's always a danger, you know, of over-medicalizing nature or over-monetizing it, but I don't think we should shrink from seeing that this is a benefit to our economy, to our health, to education. More and more pediatricians now are beginning to prescribe nature. I gave the plenary keynote address in 2010 to the National American Academy of Pediatrics Conference. There were several thousand pediatricians in the audience, and I challenged them to really begin to use nature in their practices, and many of them are now doing that. There's a pediatrician in Washington, D.C., who has organized the other pediatricians in that city to begin to prescribe nature. They've also done a database on all the parks in Washington, D.C., so that the pediatrician can not only suggest to the family that they get outside in nature, they can get on the computer and show them exactly what park is near their house. There's more and more that we can do in many of these professions. And it's not that nature is over there and has to be treated as if it's separate from us. We are part of nature. We're in nature. And this is part of our economy. This is part of education. It is part of healthcare, or should be.
There is a fascinating idea in your book, and that is the idea that there are no longer the same strong, commonly held beliefs about the perfection of nature through natural selection, through evolution. Because we've been manipulating nature so much, where are we at now? I mean, I think we're even further down this path than when you wrote the book.
Technological nature is the new phrase that's being used for it, the blending of things that we consider natural with computers and other technology. And it is troubling to watch that occur. And in fact, one of the reasons that the research on the benefits of nature to human development has only really taken place recently, has been ignored until now, is because science has a tough time defining nature in the first place. I worked with some neuroscientists for a couple of years, about 15 years ago, who were among the neuroscientists who were the dozen or so experts on brain architecture development in young children. And they were looking at what shapes the brain early on and at how toxic stress can deform,
oh my goodness,
essentially, the development of a child's brain. And they were looking at all kinds of things, on the quality of child care, for instance, on violence in the neighborhood, on all kinds of things that might change that development or affect that development. And even they were looking at some things that might affect it in a positive way, too. Could we increase that in their environment? I would ask these neuroscientists, have you ever looked at how the natural world shapes brain architecture in young children? They would look at me with a blank face, and they would say, what's nature? And the truth is that they had trouble defining it. There are at least 30 definitions in science for life. So this has been a blind spot in science. And so I would say to the neuroscientists, this isn't brain surgery. I mean, we know it when we see it. Come up with a definition of 150 trees per acre. I don't know. You guys do this all the time. And the irony was they were already doing it. They were already doing it in the lab. Because they were doing experiments with pigeons, et cetera, and they would stress out one group of pigeons, and then they would compare that to the control group, which was in a more quote-unquote natural environment in the lab. So they got the concept, but the minute you asked these scientists to step outside the lab, they were lost. So this has been a blind spot in science, and now that's being further clouded by our blending of technology with life forms. So, I don't have a magic bullet to that other than we need to value nature around us. We need to start looking and helping our children find nature, and we'll know it when we see it, and they will too.
When you're talking about that, it occurs to me that there could be so much benefit from a more interdisciplinary approach to science. I mean, there are scientists who are lost when they step out of the lab, but there are other scientists whose lab is the woods, people who are conservation biologists. And it would be so interesting for the conservation biologists and the people stressing the pigeons in the lab to actually get together and have a conversation and share notes.
Well, there would, and I think that's increasingly happening. There is a movement that has emerged, and it's a very hopeful movement. And again, if you look at the other books and the new one coming out, but particularly the Children Nature Network online, you'll see the massive numbers of studies that have come out since Last Child in the Woods that have underscored the theme of Last Child in the Woods. And increasingly, scientists are interested in this. In education, which is part of the reason why the Waldorf folks are bringing me to Santa Fe on February 21st to speak at the Lensic Performing Arts Center. I'll plug that. In education, we've been moving in all the wrong directions, as I mentioned earlier, toward less and less time outside, toward canceling recess, toward less and less experience in the real world. Meanwhile, there's this counter trend, this small counter trend that is growing, that's hopefully moving us in a different direction. And this is crucial that we begin to pay attention to this. And finally, we're starting to see some of the longitudinal studies, which weren't done 30 years ago, but are finally being done now. There's a new study out of 900 Massachusetts schools, grade schools, and they look at green schools compared to non-green schools. And what they mean by green schools is not solar panels. They mean nature around the school, in the school, a school garden, kids going outside for on field trips and all of that. And they found that the kids in the green schools, when you factor out the socioeconomic factors that might throw this off, the kids in the green schools do far better on standardized testing than the kids in the non-green schools. So, you know, we have evidence now that if we really want to improve standardized testing, we'll leave no child inside. That's one of the best things that we can do, one of the most cost-effective things we can do. And the people doing these studies say that it works best with the kids who need it most.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. I mean, there's descriptions throughout your book of kids who've never been far from home, and their life has been sort of concrete and maybe not very hospitable home life. And they're taken to the woods, or they're taken to Alaska, and their lives are changed. And one of the things that tells the reader is that you don't have to, like, live in a cabin in the woods or be out there every single day. Some of those experiences, be it a field trip or a summer camp or a trip of several days, can change a person's life and shift their way of seeing, particularly if they're young.
Well, I think that's true, and it's never too late. I mean, one of the myths is that if you don't get it when you're a kid, you'll never get it. And it's better if you get it as a child, in your early childhood, as it is with everything. The neural pathways get laid down, but the brain is plastic. The brain has a plasticity about it that can create, essentially, it can reroute the neural pathways later. Even when we're 40, 50, 60, 70 years old, we can still make new pathways in our brain. And if E.O. Wilson is right, E.O. Wilson is the great professor at Harvard who came up with the biophilia hypothesis. And that holds that we are hardwired as a species to have an affiliation with the rest of the natural world, that we need it. And if that's true, then it's already in us. Even if we never had much contact with nature, we can get it later. We can reactivate that genetic propensity. And I've seen that happen again and again. The people who work with teenagers, who work with gang members, and I've accompanied gang members on trips into the mountains, and you see this transformation. It takes a few hours, doesn't happen right away, but you see this transformation of, you know, tough 18, 19, 20-year-old gang members. By the end of the day, they're 8-year-olds jumping over, a creek.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing to watch.
We're speaking to author Richard Louvre. There is a fallacy that we have here in Santa Fe and all over the country, I think, in so many of our school systems, that technology will save us. You call this Silicon Faith. We just went through the public schools pushed for and got a very, very expensive school bond that will bring way more technology to the schools. And I was thinking about you and your book and this whole set of ideas about, I mean, what will more technology do to kids who are already screen addicted?
Well, let me make clear, I'm not anti-tech per se. I do think that we have to have a new lobby for balance, that the more high-tech our lives become, the more we need nature. The more high-tech our schools become, the more nature we need in them and around them, the more nature experience these kids need. If they don't, it's not a prescription to success later. Computers change. Nature pretty much doesn't. And we need these fundamental truths in our lives. We need this connection to something larger than what has been created by, you know, a 24-year-old computer programmer in Silicon Valley that has had way too much pizza. I mean, that is not the ultimate source of truth. And it turns out when you look at the studies, the computers in the classroom, there's not that much evidence, actually, that these are great teaching tools. They're necessary in society. It's necessary to learn about them. But there's actually more evidence that music and art and, in fact, nature experience can raise test scores. And yet that evidence is ignored by school boards who we think they're making their choices based on scientific evidence, evidence-based decisions. I think they're making their decisions often based on faith, on a kind of religion that may or may not be called religion. It has to do with our faith in technology. Yeah. Again, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have technology in our schools. I am saying that for every dollar that we spend on the virtual in education, we ought to be spending at least another dollar on the real, on the natural. And if we do that, the kids will be okay. What if that school bond had matched every dollar that it was raising for technology in the schools with another dollar to get the kids out on field trips, to have community gardens, to have school gardens, to have more nature in and around the school? What if they had done that? I'd be very pleased with that. I think a lot of people would. But instead, they moved to this out-of-balance position. And the fact is that there is no lobby for balance today. The great lobby now is from the technology companies, and they have a horse in the race. They have product to move. And so it's in their interest to get school districts to overload kids with technology. And the irony is, the great irony is, that Steve Jobs did not let his kids play with iPads. Bill Gates, out, is a similar kind of parent. It's amazing how many of the leaders in Silicon Valley, in the tech businesses, have cabins in the mountains off the grid where they go to be restored so they can come back and be better programmers. They can come back and have better technology companies. But they don't talk about that. I would like to convince them to be leaders as well in the children and nature movement, in this new nature movement, which really is a movement for balance, not only in our schools, but where we live, work, learn, and play.
Not only is nature a huge component in mental health and in intellectual development for children and all throughout life, as you make this argument, and I think there's so much to that, but even beyond that, there is a place for a kind of moral education that you talk about and a kind of spiritual solace. For so many people, their church is nature, their sense of awe, their sense of wonder, their sense of amazement. And even people who are genuinely quote-unquote religious people based in specific faiths have nature as a basis. I wonder if you could talk more about that.
Well, you know, when I wrote Last Child in the Woods and also The Nature Principle, each of them have a chapter about the spiritual necessity of nature, both for kids and for adults. And when I wrote Last Child, I was concerned that would turn off a lot of people who worry that somebody like me is going to come along and try to get their kids to worship nature, which I don't do. I don't agree with them, but I respect their point of view. But as it turned out, none of that happened. In fact, one of the first supporters of Last Child in the Woods was a president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Pat Robertson had me on his show on the 700 Club. And I puzzled over that because I thought that I would be, getting, hard criticism from the religious right for having said that, contact with nature was important for spiritual development for children. I meant that in the broadest way, by the way, spiritual development. And in fact, the opposite happened. And I came to the conclusion over time, whatever the faith is, that smart people who have a faith in something larger intuitively know that all spiritual life begins with a sense of wonder. What is one of the first windows into wonder that children experience? maybe if you're like me, you know, it's crawling out through the grass to where the grass ends and the woods began, and you turn over a rock and you look underneath it and you find for the first time that you're not alone in the universe, that there is something out there. There is something in the wind that you can hear. There are voices that are there. And that moment of awe and wonder is endangered, and nobody wants to be in the last generation where that disappears. And for many children, that is disappearing, and we can turn that around.
This book that you wrote about 10 years ago, Last Child in the Woods, was a really major bestseller, and I was wondering if you could talk about the effect that this book has actually had on people, on school systems, on maybe Boy Scouting and Girl Scouting, things like that.
Well, first, it's, you know, there are people working on this issue long before Last Child in the Woods came along, and I acknowledge that, you know, Last Child in the Woods was not the reason that a movement emerged. It turned out to be a very handy tool for the movement that has emerged, and it is increasing in velocity. It's reaching China. It's reaching Australia. I'm going to Europe next month because there's increasing desire to turn this trend around and to go in a new direction. I never talk about going back to nature. I talk about going forward to nature. We really do need to think about the future in a new way. And I'm afraid that our culture accepts the idea. I mean, I'm convinced that most people in America, for instance, if you ask them to conjure up images of the far future, those images look a lot like Blade Runner and Mad Max, and at best, The Hunger Games. At least there's a few trees. One young woman, a college student, says, told me, "I'm 20 years old, and all my life I've been told it's too late." And I think that we're in danger of a whole generation turning back on hope, of feeling that it is too late. Part of that is the message that environmentalism itself sends out unintentionally with all the best intentions. And it's part of the reason that my profession of journalism, we're partly at fault here because we've been sending out this message. It's not that the problems aren't huge environmentally. It's that we haven't been talking about the rest of the story enough. We, you know, Martin Luther King said and demonstrated in many ways that any movement, any culture will fail if it cannot paint a picture of a world that people will want to go to. I no longer talk about a sustainable future because it's hard to paint that picture in your mind. It's important. But if we stop at a discussion of energy efficiency, we won't get to energy efficiency. We have to aim a lot higher. That's why I talk in these books and in the, you know, the book coming out about a nature-rich future, a nature-rich world, nature-rich cities, nature-rich homes, nature-rich schools, a nature-rich life. That kind of future you can imagine. You can begin to attach new images in your mind. You can see that future, and most of us, I think, will want to go to that future.
Richard Louv is author of several books, including Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. He will be speaking at 7 o'clock in the evening on Sunday, the 21st of February, at the Lenzig Performing Arts Center. It's part of the program, The New Nature Movement, hosted by the Santa Fe Waldorf School. The presenting sponsor is the Journey Montessori School. You can get tickets directly through the Lenzig at 988-1234. You can also go to ticketssantafe.com. Anything else that you want to let people know before we go today?
No, I think you've covered a lot. And I'm looking forward to seeing people in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I spent a lot of time there, and I think that, you know, your license plate slogan, by the way, Land of Enchantment, it's the only license plate in America that tells the truth. So, I love New Mexico. So I'll see you there. Thanks.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Great.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.